everyone, and welcome to another edition of Unplugged. We join you with a feeling of relief more than anything. It wasn't super by any means, as most people would acknowledge. It was hard work. It was a tough slog during the first half. It was utterly frustrating. And we spoke about last week the loss to Essendon left us precarious in the situation where we're expected to beat Richmond, but if we didn't, we're in all sorts of trouble, and we're sitting there staring at that cliff for probably much of the first half of the game, thinking we dropped a game we should never have lost. Now we're going to butcher this one in an awkward ground against a side that's hungry, and you know, we put in a shocker at just the worst time, and it's going to ruin the whole year. But sometimes you just have to pass a character test. You're not playing particularly well. It's not a day that's been super for you, but you just have to find a way. And I think they were able to do that. And pleasingly, it was leadership in a lot of respects that sort of dragged them over the line, the skipper and various others that were able to do it. And look, that's okay. You're going to win ugly sometimes. There's a lot to work on out of the game. There's a lot that needs to improve out of the game. But they got there. Third quarter was, I guess, as well as they've played in a little while, but after a diabolical first half, it must be said. And Nick, before we jump into the reviews of the game, and I'll get you to kick it off in a minute, you've got a bit of a public service announcement for those who may be joining us off the bat here.
Oh, just quickly, obviously everyone's kind of aware, I think, of the challenges that media organisations, you know, podcasts, publishers, etc., having with Facebook, with Meta, and the possibility of Meta leaving the Australian environment in the next couple of months. So obviously Facebook is a big part of what we do. We'd love it if you could follow or subscribe elsewhere at our other channels on Twitter or TikTok, mm-hmm. and YouTube especially, I think, because there is a probably a 50-50 chance that Facebook leaves our shores in the next couple of months. So if you are a fan of the podcast, give us a follow on YouTube, on Twitter, on TikTok, or wherever you are, and just I guess stay in touch that way. We do have an email subscription on our website, which you can find in the bios on all our channels as well. Which, you know, it'd be great if you sign up to as well, and we can send you weekly update whenever we launch a new podcast. But really, yeah, I mean, wherever you can follow and engage with us, it'd be great. We are on TikTok. We are on YouTube. If you prefer a video podcast, you can get us on YouTube. So, yeah, just in the occasion that we do lose Facebook and Instagram over the next, you know, 3 or 4 months, we'd love if you could jump on and follow or subscribe on our other platforms and other channels, just to give us a chop out. So thank you in advance.
Absolutely. So hopefully our loyal band can jump across, and if you haven't done that already, do that for us. But yeah, Nick, I think you wrote in the comments here, nearly a 332-game stretch at outgoing goalless in a half for Ross Lyon. I think the last time we were goalless at halftime of any game was 1986. We lost that game by 140 to Carlton, but somehow we won this one.
I'll tell you, in the first 12 minutes of that game, I thought a 100-point loss was on the cards. They jumped us early. And I guess one of the questions I wanted to put to you, we saw – I don't know if it was Friday or on Saturday, we saw the pictures of Richmond training at Punt Road, and they'd marked out the wing specs, the boundary specs at Punt Road, so they could train within the specs of Norwood Oval. Obviously, being very, very skinny wings, very little pocket space. It's a very, very narrow ground. And obviously, we didn't handle that well in Geelong in round one as well. I think it was the one thing that we didn't do. I thought we played pretty well in round one other than that, but we just didn't handle the specs of the ground itself. And I think that we didn't adapt again to the ground size. And I think maybe, you know, Ross talked about it at his presser on Thursday or Friday, whatever it was, that, you know, we should be able to play on a car park. We should be able to be ready to play anywhere. But we didn't do anything in terms of preparation for this ground. We didn't mark out Moorabbin. We didn't mark out specific space to prepare for the narrowness of Norwood Oval. And I just wonder if we got that wrong, and maybe if we had our time again, would we change that preparation? Because they did jump us, and it did feel like whenever we got the ball early in the game, and I don't want to talk too much about the first half because it was awful. And we spoke last week about kind of the depressing nature of doing this podcast sometimes, and you know, talking about some of those awful performances. But in that first half, we just didn't handle it. We didn't handle it well, and they handled it better than us and felt like they were better prepared. When we got the ball, we had nowhere to go. We had no one to kick to. We had no one running past. We had no space. Whereas whenever they won the ball, they had players everywhere ready for a handball off, ready for a short chip out to the wing, you know, whatever it was, they had space everywhere. And it just felt like, you know, Ross has had his detractors over the year, and I think over the years, I should say. And I feel like I'm a big advocate for bringing Ross back. I've loved what we've seen since he's come back in the club. I feel like we can trust where we're at and what we do each week, that we know who's going to turn up and whatever. And it just wasn't that we didn't turn up, because I think we did turn up. The effort, I think, was there, but we just didn't prepare well enough for that abnormal speck of the ground. And I wonder if Ross, being the perfectionist that he is, I wonder if he just got it wrong this week. I mean, what do you guys think?
Maybe. And look, H, I'll throw that to you as well, because it felt like Norwood, the smallest ground that they play AFL on in the country, that Richmond was spreading into 50 metres of space. Mm. And you're thinking, well, exactly, how are they doing that when there's no room on this ground? And you're right. I mean, effort was there, but execution was miles off. Like in the first two minutes of the game, we were missing tackles. We turned the ball over two or three times, and you just get, I don't know, H, you get that sinking feeling sometimes. Like 2 minutes in, I'm like, this looks awful. And it obviously started that way. And but yeah, that was probably the most alarming part, was how much space they found on a tiny ground.
Yeah. I mean, as you say, this is a very different podcast of what it could have been, but it's amazing how on such a narrow ground, how narrow we went. We made the ground look 100 meters wide, even more than that, because I think from wing to wing was about 90 meters or something like that. Quite small.
I think it's 108.
Oh, so it's even bigger than I thought it was. Yeah,
it's less than. It's bigger than you think, but it's still less
but
than
we
GMHBA.
We played so narrow, and all of a sudden you'd see there'd be three, four Richmond players running down the wing by themselves, and we're going,
yeah,
where are we? Where have we gone? But we've just attacked that corridor so hard and lost the ball, and then it's gone. They've just run around the side of us. And you look at how Geelong play Geelong, and they do that to teams there. They've got that one square wing, and they do it there week after week after week, and teams can't beat it. And you sort of think, you know exactly what you need to do to stop that, but teams just don't do it. And it seems like that's pretty well how we went into the game, and we played a certain way, and Richmond just had a way to go, no, we're just going to keep going that way. But when you look at it too, you sort of think that what we saw in the second half, the effort that we saw in that third quarter particularly, just wasn't there in the first half. We might have been playing exactly the same game, but we just didn't have that effort in the first half. And it was scary sitting there thinking, going, this could get really, really ugly if we actually don't put any effort. And do we break even or just had almost a same amount of scoring shots as him in the first half almost, or it was pretty close, I think, in the end, wasn't it? So
yeah, we kicked about, I think they had two more scoring shots, but we kicked two out in the full as well. So
it's not we didn't have the opportunity. We had the opportunity.
Yeah.
The kicking a goal, up one end we had to kick at the right post, the other end you had to kick at the left post, and both times we're going, well, we didn't. Max King had the same shot from two shots from the same spot in a row and pretty much kicked the same ball.
Didn't
learn from the first kick. Thinking just those little things, you think, well, you saw what happened in the first one. You know what you got to do now. But we didn't learn when things went wrong. And that seemed to be the problem until we actually went in and, as I say, Ross called the aliens in, we completely changed, and it was a completely different game. And we play as well in that, as well we played in that third quarter. If we played the first or the second quarter that well, it's a 7-8 goal win. And that's a simple way to look at it, that it just was not there in the first half.
Parker, I want to ask you, because you've talked about the AFL and the competition in general for a long time and been on record talking about the competition in general for a long time, but I want to ask you about playing the game at Norwood and that decision. I mean, we know that both St Kilda and Richmond have large supporter bases in Melbourne. You know, Richmond is a mass. Obviously, they've had kind of half a decade of incredible success. And their supporter base, their membership base is humongous now. I would suggest that our supporter base would be similar to Richmond, but our membership base isn't.
Yeah, that's fair.
But we do know that Saints fans travel, whether they're members or not, Saints fans travel, especially to Adelaide. We get good coverage for our fan base in Adelaide. We get good coverage of our fan base in Perth. There are particular places around the country that our fans go to every year, and we get a large travelling contingent going to Adelaide. We know that there is a large St Kilda contingent in Adelaide already. Did the AFL make the wrong call playing this game at Norwood as opposed to Adelaide?
Possibly. I'm sort of torn on it in the sense that, look, that's correct. And look, Collingwood played Hawthorn at the Adelaide Oval, and you just know they're not going to put that game at Norwood, for example. Sure. But that's exactly the point we're trying to make, that St Kilda, Richmond, Collingwood, Hawthorn, you know, much of a muchness, which one, you know, Collingwood are the reigning premiers, but which one's going to draw a bigger crowd out of those two? You know, I'm also a romantic football fan in that it's, you know, it's a nice looking ground. It's going out to a different venue, and it's, you know, I like the gather round concept. And so I don't mind that. But I mean, there's a thousand thoughts in my head. One, St Kilda always seems to struggle when they play at random venues like China, Cairns, Wellington, Townsville. New Zealand, Townsville, those sorts of things where they, I don't know why that's the case, but it seems to happen that way. So I was nervous about that, thinking, are we going to handle this? And we didn't. But then, you know, it's probably my biggest annoyance would be at a more mainstream venue having to play there when other sides don't, like playing Geelong at Cadinia Park annoys me more than that. That's a much harder fixture, and it's a fixture that teams like Collingwood and Carlton and Essendon and teams like that just don't get. And that is a clear disparity in the competition. So that annoys me probably more. I can probably live with it in gather round in a neutral type setting. But, you know, if we had to play to Adelaide there or something, it might have been a bit more annoying. But
yeah, for sure. Yeah. I guess the question goes back to, like, well, I mean, what do they have it at Norwood? Was it 9-8? Just around 10, something like that. Like you get to Moorabbin, you get eight, just over eight. If you put in, a couple more seating areas around the hill area at Moorabbin, like why couldn't we play a GWS or a Gold Coast or whatever at Moorabbin? Like it's just
well, they were talking about gather round being a 3-week thing in a couple of years, with one of the weeks being in Melbourne, and I'm like, well, if they did that, I would assume that you'd play Moorabbin,
Vic Park,
Victoria Park, Icon Park, those sorts. I mean, but then again, some venues, like you can't play AFL at Punt Road at the moment, that type of thing. Waverley you couldn't play at.
Waverley you couldn't do.
No, so Windy Hill's not really, I mean, it's a dive anyway, but I mean, like, they're not going to play at a Tullamarine. Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of work to be done.
Although they're saying gather round in the Barossa next year, which would be cool. Mm. I'd go over for that.
Yeah. Yeah, that'd be
weekend
that'd
be in wine some country. Extra perks. Couldn't be horrible.
Extra perks involved in that, but yeah. Look, I don't mind it as a one-off. I don't think that's a disadvantage, whereas Cadinia Park perhaps is. Mm. But yeah, I think in terms of wrapping a bow on that, I mean, a lot of what we'll say would probably come down to votes. Probably a comment on Darcy Wilson. You know, I still think that's a work in progress, and like he's done a couple of things this year that have, you know, need a bit of work, like the handball over the head against Collingwood and some of those sorts of things. But the chase down tackle in the last quarter and his knock on and his
There's
run
two of them in the last quarter,
yeah, that's very encouraging. And I think, look, he was close to a rising star nom. I think Darcy from the Dogs got it, and Harley Reid may have if he didn't. But yeah, that type of performance takes
gets
him close.
It was Sam Darcy, so it got this week. So but yeah, I mean, he's our Mateus this year. Ross kept playing Mateus because he knows what he can do. He knows the ability, but he wants those games in him to get that out of them. And that's the only way you can get it. You can't go, oh, week in, week out, few weeks at the VFL, come back for a week, go back out again. That's not going to get him to where we want him to be. You've got to play these guys these games. And we're starting to see it through Mateus. He knows what's going on. He's giving us a bit, and he's just going to keep growing too, because he's going to keep getting the games. And I mean, anyone that I've seen so many people going, oh, he needs to be dropped. He's not up to it. He's not that. He's 18. Come on. And as I was saying, he's not going to get any better if he does not play these games. So he's putting out more than quite a few of the first year draftees you see at the moment already. And that's what we want. We want him in there. We want him to get playing games. We want him learning about it. And the only place to learn about the top league is in the top league. There's nothing to learn in the VFL. And you can learn a position or something, but you're not getting the same experience. It's far the difference between them. So,
we don't talk a lot of betting on this podcast, but Harley Reid's a favourite for the Rising Star. Darcy Wilson's well down that. I think he's probably 10 or 11 lines down that market. He's about $23
currently.
Yeah, 26 on a couple of books as well. I imagine that when he does get that nomination, that's going to half probably.
Yeah.
And if you do like – there's probably some value there for Darcy Wilson if you do like him to have a bit of a crack at the Rising Star, because he has shown enough to be in that conversation. People aren't really talking about him, so he's going a little bit under the radar, but he's been excellent.
There will be the breakout game that will put him on the map, and
And we got him for, you know, the run, and he's demonstrated that he can do that. So we'll wrap up, slightly shorter wrap of that game, understandably, I guess something of a great escape, but we'll wrap it up with the votes and the awards. Rowan Marshall gets one for me. I think his second half, he probably gets seven, but in the first half, he was well and truly beaten by Nankervis. He redeemed himself with an excellent second half and one of those leaders who got us home. Riley Bonner, I think, went at something like 92% this week. That was exactly the response we wanted from, you know, he was poor last week in a high possession game. He struggled against Collingwood. That was much better. Wanganeen Miller, you know, one of our best players now officially and one of our most consistent players without a doubt. Cal Wilkie, his last quarter, I mean, he was dropping marks against Essendon, which was uncharacteristic, didn't drop marks this time, stood up in the way and played a typical Cal Wilkie game. Jack Sinclair, a bit stiff not to get to. He was very good. In the first half, he was one of our only players that wasn't fumbly and handled the conditions well. Josh Battle, he's had an excellent month, but that's almost the best game I've seen him play. Mixed defence with attack, took 13 marks, had 25 possessions. He was outstanding in the first half and then kept it going in the second. And then Jack Steele, we don't win the game without his influence as a leader. He gets three votes, basically lifted the side in the second half and then helped drag them home in the final term. And he looks back to his best. But H, your votes?
Yeah, it was a weird one. It was kind of hard to squeeze a few in. I couldn't quite get Nazzy in this week. I was just like, he was there. He's did what we expect him to do now sort of thing, but couldn't squeeze him in. And, yeah, there's another player that was sort of a bit like, I got to the end of my 10 votes and went, oh, I haven't got them in anywhere. I'm like, I just can't because they, just weren't the first players that came to my mind basically. But as you're saying, Bonner, I mean, came back with a vengeance this week. Nice goal from the boundary from a tight spot that gave us a, like, it came at a really crucial point of the game as well. Josh Bell, the candy man, as you said, just, beautiful football on the day. Just, it did everything was asked of him, gave us drive out of the back line, popped up when we needed him. Just, as you say, probably his best game for a while for the club. I thought Hill ran well. It was when he got knocked down, I mean, there was a bit of concern there for sure. Sort of just sitting there hoping, going, just please let that be a knock. Please let it be a knock. And
I thought for sure they were going to sub him and bring Hasty on at that point.
Yeah, I mean, it felt like it was going to happen, but just going, the run he was giving us at times there, and you're thinking, it was a crucial to get him back kind of thing. And he came back out and he, yeah, got the ball in a few tight spots where we needed the breakaway again. And so thankfully he was right. S.A. Marshall, when he started mimicking basically what Mankervis was doing for Richmond, that's when he stepped into the game. He saw what Mankervis was providing them and said, I'm going to do exactly the same thing for us. And that changed his game completely and yeah, gave us some really good service there. Zeb Ross, I thought, was really good again. I haven't heard his name come up much, but I was quite pleased with what he did, to be honest. Another great game. He's had quite a good month now. So Sinclair, too. Again, as you're saying, you wanted to give him two but couldn't get it in. But, yeah, two definitely for, I guess, a vote for each half for being consistent. And, yeah, Jack Steele stood up above and beyond on the day and just led us all the way for the whole game.
Decent chance Nicky might win his own award again, but your votes.
Yeah, well, I wanted to ask, H, you're the controller of the MVP award. I'd love to know if maybe you have the numbers by the end of the episode or if not, maybe by next week. When the last time Jack Steele got maximum votes from all three of us, because I'm not sure it's happened that often since he won the first two variations of this award. But, pretty similar to you guys. I gave Riley Bonner one vote. I thought it was kind of his redemption game. I think he played a bit like he had a chip on his shoulder, like he had something to prove. And I think that he kind of worked his way into the game, even when we weren't as a team playing very well. And maybe this goes back to Parco, what you were saying last week about Riley Bonner kind of playing his own game that doesn't quite fit in with what we're doing as a team. And I don't know if that's a positive or negative in this sense, but I thought he was pretty good while we were not very good. Mm-hmm. And then I thought he was good while we were good in the second half. And I thought that he probably showed a bit to everyone that had kind of knocked him, I guess, over the last couple of weeks. Josh Battle, I gave one vote. I think we've seen him play a lot of good footy over the last 5 years, and there's been periods both as a forward and as a defender that he's played some good footy in patches. This might be the best four-week patch of his career so far, and there's nothing that says that this is just a flash in the pan, that this is just a good period for him. This is the way that he's playing that kind of centre-half back role says to me that this is sustainable now for the rest of his career. This is the benchmark for the rest of his career. Josh Battle has been super, and I would be astounded if he wasn't at this stage. If we look forward to hopefully October, that Josh Battle isn't top five in the best and fairest at this stage. Obviously, a long way to go, but I think he's been excellent and our best defender consistently over the first month of the season. Zane Cordy, I gave a vote because I thought he was our best player in the first half. I thought he and Jack Steele kept us in the game in the first half. Jack Steele was racked up touches. He got a lot of the ball in the first half, but a lot of it was at the bottom of a pack, almost not noticeable, but at halftime when it said he'd had 16 or 17 touches, it was like, shit, where? Like, I haven't seen us win the ball. But Steele had kind of, 15 to 20 touches already. Cordy, I thought, was a lot more noticeable in the first half that he was the guy that stood up in defense and really led the line and was the guy that said, you're not getting past me. And I know that there was a lot of, it was Shea Bolton and Dusty and whatever doing the damage early, but Zane Cordy really stood up as that last line of defense and went, no, this, I'm not going to let this happen. And the fact that we were only kind of 4 to 5 goals down at quarter time, he was a massive part of that. And we don't win that game without Zane Cordy, I don't think. So I would have loved to give him more votes, but I think a lot of guys stood up in the second half that probably took some votes away because it didn't spend as much time down there. But obviously, in that first half, it spent a lot of time in our defensive half. Rowan Marshall, I thought, really stepped up. You mentioned H. The way that he kind of combated Nank. And Nank, played a bit of an unconventional ruckman's role in that he kind of contested the stoppage and then moved back and played the Sicily Stewart, third man up, tall intercept defender type role. And either he played that to perfection or we just treated him as if we do a James Sicily, Tom Stewart, Stephen May kind of guy, that we just kept kicking it to him all day. And it was infuriating at halftime just seeing Toby Nanguas, who, like, he's a good player. He's a good, honest battler. You know, he deserves everything that's come his way as an AFL career, but like, he's not a superstar. He's not Stephen May. He's not James Sicily. He's not Tom Stewart. The fact that this dude is just killing us as an intercept defender was just infuriating. And Rowan Marshall did a really good job in the second half, I think, of negating and then beating Toby Nankervis in the second half. And I thought he was super. Nazaya, I think he was good in the first half, and then he stepped up in the second half. I gave him a vote because his disposal is just incredible. And he was willing to do things with the ball that others weren't. Didn't always come off, but you know that with someone like Naz, he's going to attack, he's going to be offensive, and he's going to try and make things happen. And it, like I said, didn't always work in the first half, but I think as we got our structure right and as we adapted better, you know, essentially from the first bounce of the third quarter, he was amazing. And there was there's a St Kilda Stats Twitter account that talked about the number of, I think it was 20 possession games or 25 possession games consecutive for Naz. And I mean, just, we all see what he does when he's got ball in hand. But I think, like I said last week or the week before, we don't talk often enough about his defensive efforts and his attack on the ball and his contest and strength at the ball. And he looks skinny and weak and whatever, but he just hits the ball real hard. And I love the way he goes about it. Jack Sinclair, I thought, was a two-vote game. I thought he was pretty good. The only thing that kind of held me back from giving him more was that while he was very impactful, it wasn't the Jack Sinclair type of game that we've seen over the last 2 years. And if this is Sinclair building, then over the next month or 6 weeks or the second half of this season, we're in a really good spot because Jack Sinclair can get a lot better. And he was really good, especially in the second half. He was really good. And I'm really looking forward to seeing him play his best footy and Jack Steele play his best footy and Nazaya play his best footy and Rowan Marshall play his best footy and Josh Battle play his best footy, you know, over the next 12 weeks. Because if we get those guys all playing great footy at the same time, like, we're in a great spot, and that's really positive. And Jack Steele, like you said, it probably wasn't his best game of footy. Like, we've seen Jack Steele put on the Superman cape and just do incredible things. But what he did was a real captain's game and just did what needed to be done to get his team over the line. And we've seen him play better, but I'm not sure that there's been many games where we've seen him play harder for four quarters. Like, aside from Cordy in that first half, like I said, Jack Steele was almost a one-man band in that first half. The way that he worked and built and just the toughness and courage to do what he does, I think is underrated still for Jack Steele. And I
thought he was definitely. He was. And look, yeah, there are a lot of apologies based on all of that as well. I thought, sure. Wilson himself, a bit of an apology. Even Jack Higgins, again, in a low-scoring game, I thought did a little bit all the way through, which mattered.
Well, that Blake first goal was so important. Like, two minutes to go in the second quarter, it was so important.
And the last 10 seconds in the third, plus he set up the Mitch Owens goal with a superb handball inbound in the third quarter as well. So there's three of our nine again that he's had a hand in. Nearly kicked a couple more, but we'll just knock over the other awards. The Jason Blake Award this week. I think there's one that will get mentioned, so I anticipate my thunder will be stolen. But
yeah, I mean, he got a vote from Nick, but I'd say Cordy was the one I was going to throw up. Probably one of the ones that I looked and went, oh, I would love to have given him a vote, but just couldn't fit him in. And he was just solid down back. Just did the job, did the basically what we needed him to do down there on the day. And I mean, you kind of think, well, yes, we were lucky that Lynch wasn't playing and just all that sort of he's in the right, I guess, the right place for that day. He's going to have to do more of that, I guess, with Dougal coming up fit. And, yeah, he did everything that would have been asked of him on the weekend. So he can keep providing us with that sort of thing. Yeah, it's going to make one hard for Dougal to get back. I mean, as much as he's probably automatic, you'd assume. But, yeah, it makes it hard to actually drop him when it comes to that point. So, yeah, keep going, Zane.
100%. Nick, yours?
Yeah. It's Cordy for me. I gave him a vote, and I did kind of toss up whether if you give him a vote, can you then give him this award? And I think so, because I think he's one of those guys that I think goes unrecognized at times, and we saw it last year when he came in and played a role both forward and back. He's just a really important part of our squad. And whether or not he plays every week, and obviously Dougal coming back throws a bit of a spanner in the works in terms of where he fits into the lineup and whether you can play both Cordy and Howard in the same team. I don't know, but what I've and I wasn't a huge fan of signing Zane Cordy kind of 18 months ago or whatever it was, but he's proven me wrong big time, because whenever he's stepped in, I'm not sure he's played a bad game for us. His worst game, I think, has probably been solid. You know, he's played a role. And even when it was forward and he had one touch, that one touch was a goal. You know, a goal when it was needed. You know, not just one goal when we're six goals up, but one goal when we're 4 points up or a couple of points down or whatever, and he'd take a strong mark and kick straight. And when he's played back, he's played games like he did on Sunday, where he's just... You know, he's taken the best key forward and he's just done a job. It certainly wasn't, and I know they've had injuries and whatever up forward for Richmond, but it was the smalls that did damage for them early. But Zane Cordy didn't put a foot wrong, and I think that you know what you're going to get out of Zane Cordy. Dougal Howard, I think, is a better footballer. I think he's a better player. But you get the ups and downs, as we've talked about for a couple of years, the space cadet decision-making and whatever. And there's pros and cons, but Zane Cordy is that very level. You know what you're going to get. Doesn't make a lot of mistakes. Doesn't get a lot of the ball. Doesn't make a lot of mistakes and that sort of thing. And I'm really happy with Zane as kind of the backup fullback. And if there's a way that you can get Howard and Cordy to work together, then I'm all in to have a look at that, at what that looks like. I just think that Cordy doesn't get the credit that he deserves. And this week, even though I gave him a vote, I think it's just kind of the build-up of a long period where he hasn't got that credit. So I wanted to give it to Zane.
Yeah, I just had a quick look. He's had, including last year, so his last nine games, he's had 61 one-percenters. That's a big number.
That's a when big you number.
Compared to other players, and it's a big number. So it means he might not be getting a possession for what he does. He might not get a stat for it, but just throwing himself in there and doing the little thing to get the ball moving or getting it to us, which is huge. I mean,
we've spoken so much about Cal Wilkie and his decision-making, all that sort of stuff, and historically his ability to deliver, disposal efficiency, etc. Zane Cordy played, I think, 89% game time, 88% game time, 100% disposal efficiency from 15 touches, 18 of which were kicks. You know, and if you're getting that kind of out of your fullback and your key defender, then you're in a pretty good spot.
I think so. And look, I'm similar part of the grounds. I mean, I could have given it to both Wilkie and Bonner for responding to the week before. I mean, Wilkie never plays a bad game. That was about as close as it gets to it against Essendon, and he responded. But look, Riley Bonner, I think, given, you know, the record 17 turnovers, to then be one of our best ball users a week later and play a really pivotal role. I think, I mean, you know, Shannon, the award around the Jason Blake and the Shannon Noll. I mean, the Shannon Noll is you need a lift, and the Jason Blake is you do the job when it matters most. And I think he's gone from one category straight into the other, so he gets mine. Speaking of Shannon Noll, Nick, did you have an obvious standout this week?
Well, I mean, in the first half, you probably could have picked 18 players of guys that need to lift. I think there's a real obvious one, which is there's a couple of obvious ones. I think if you look at some of the Facebook groups and social media and who they're talking about in terms of guys they want dropped and have to work hard and whatever, there's kind of Filippo and obviously Wilkie last week. The guys talking last week about Cal Wilkie had to be dropped because he had one bad game in 100 and whatever it is that he's played now. Ryan Burns is one who's always he's always going to be on the periphery of the squad, right? Whether he's a best 26 player or a best 22 player, he's never going to be a top 8 player on the list. It's never going to happen. It's like going back to 09-10 when you had Rob Eddy and McWalter and Clint Jones and those guys. They're never going to be top 5 players in the list or whatever, but he plays a role. And I thought that, again, he kind of played a role, although this was probably his worst game of the year for Ronnie Burns. But I do think that he's proven enough over the last month that he is in our best 23 at the moment. Mateus Filippo is a really interesting one because he is incredibly talented. He's incredibly talented. And I do feel like he needs to lift, but I almost feel like that's on the coaching staff to get that to happen because I'm not sure they're utilizing him in the most efficient way possible at the moment. I do feel like over the next 5 to 10 years, he's going to be a very, very good midfielder, like a Bontempelli, you know, the best midfielders in the league, but he's not there yet. And I feel like he'd be best utilized right now, half forward flank, you know, kind of lead up forward, head up to the wing, get some uncontested ball and be able to use his weapons, which is his disposal, his big left foot, you know, hit the scoreboard, all that sort of stuff, which we've seen him do in patches this year. But he was able to do last year, playing more forward than midfield. This year, you know, we've seen him more midfield and Mitch Owens spend more time forward. I think there's a swap here. And so my Shannon Knoll lift award is to Ross, and it's to get Mateus playing a role that suits him now. Like, I know we want to develop him and get him in to be an A-grade midfielder in a few years, but we want to be playing finals this year. We're playing both for the future and for the now. And I think to get the best of both worlds, you get Mateus forward of center and get him impacting, hitting the scoreboard, impacting offensively. And I think that we'll see better results right now from Mateus and still develop his game at the same time. But I think he's just best suited there and get more game time into Mitch in the middle at the same time.
I think that's a fair shout, hey?
It was a point that we had had in our run sheet earlier here, and we didn't really bring it up during the game review, but yeah, Channel 7, your camera work is awful. Absolutely awful. I mean, the Max Kidd goal, that would have been fantastic.
Oh, I was
going
to say.
If we saw it.
Yeah.
I was sitting there going, sorry, we kicked the goal, dude. Where'd it come from?
It was incredible. Yeah.
Yeah. And it was just so bad on the day. I don't know if the feed going back to the truck was no good or what it was, but the camera just was just facing the wrong end of the ground at times. So as good as, our second half was, we only saw half of what happened. So, it was just one that I was looking at because, I didn't go sort of anywhere at the team this week. Well, I think we've covered the bits and pieces, but that was probably the most, most frustrating part of what I saw on the weekend.
I think that's all correct. Mine's probably just where this award in a lot of ways kind of started would be Dan Butler. I just think he looks a bit rusty. He'll be okay. But, you know, started okay against Essendon, sort of faded, minimal impact in this game against Richmond. I think obviously Higgins playing well is covering that a little bit. But, look, I like the Filippo nomination in that he's generally a beautiful kick. The last couple of weeks he's sprayed a few shots at goal that he would normally kick, so whether that's a confidence thing. But, I think if Butler can, you know, get back to where we want him to be, then I think that really does help us.
For a game that we didn't want to talk a lot about, we've just done 40 minutes.
That's right. And we are looking forward to our next guest. It has been a popular request when we have asked people who they'd like to hear from, and that is Super Duper Bruce Duperuzel. In terms of guests, we've done a couple of things by fluke in the last couple of weeks. We happened to get Stephen Ziller last week by chance when St Kilda was playing Richmond in South Australia. He's a South Australian and played for St Kilda and Richmond, and discovered that last week was 50 years to the day that our next guest played his first game for the Saints, was part of a big successful influx of Western Australian talent that St Kilda had through the 60s and 70s, and when you count Nicky Winmar through to the 80s as well. But you look at Brian Sirikowski, John McIntosh, the Sidebottom brothers, of course, George Young, Russell Reynolds, and Bruce Duperreuzel, who is our guest on the podcast this week. And Bruce, nice to have you with us. 139 games with the Saints before a brief stint with Footscray, but nice to have you on. We'll go back to that. Obviously, there were a lot of your fellow Western Australians. We'll talk about your other career in sport in WA with cricket a little bit later on, but George Young a little bit before you and some of those others. What got you to the Saints? Was it a little bit of that factor, the connection that the club seemed to have with the West?
Sort of what happened, I think, in the early 70s, there was a bit of a connection between Claremont and St Kilda. And I think I was probably very fortunate. I came direct from school. I was at boarding school for a few years in Perth, and I wanted to play with Claremont, who they recruited me. I was a York boy, which is a farming community about 100 miles east of Perth. And Dennis Marshall was my first coach, and I think I was very lucky having him, because he had come. He was a Claremont boy who had gone to Geelong, and was a very pretty impressive footballer at Geelong as sort of a halfback flanker, ruck rover, and they brought him back to Claremont in 1969 when I joined Claremont, and he was my first coach, and he really brought back, I guess, VFL feel to a club that was probably going through a little bit of a tough time. And funnily enough, not much has changed in 50 years, because by the end of that first year, I played in a last few games, and there were 15 first-year players in the team. So he cleaned it out, as they say, and got together a group sort of to come through, and 3 years later, I think in 72, we played off in the grand final. So in some ways, not much has changed in all those years when you think about it, that you get the right group of players together and keep them together, which is a lot more difficult these days with the way the game's played. But so I started with Dennis, and then we had a pre-season game with St Kilda. We came over to Melbourne, and I happened to get a few kicks, so I had Ian Drake and Graham Huggins chasing me, and I ended up signing with them in early 1970, I think in May, and they were pretty happy because I made the state team in 1970, and WA came across to the MCG to play Victoria, and Graham Farmer was our coach, captain coach. And I happened to sneak around Mal Brown in those couple of hours, and I kicked six on the MCG, and I had a lot of clubs chasing me in the Monday. And Drakey and Hugo were pretty happy that the ink had dried and I was tired as St Kilda, which I was happy about, because I certainly wanted to pursue my career over here, even though there was really no money in the game, you know, in those days. And in fact, just probably 1.2 was, I noticed too that Russell Reynolds and George Young, it was 51 years this week, in the first week of April when the season started, it was 51 years that they'd come across and played their first game at St Kilda, because they came the year before I did, yes.
Incredible timing to get you on this week. But I wanted to ask you, was it always a goal of yours to come to play footy in Melbourne? Because obviously you're growing up in WA. The WA NFL, as it was at that stage, was a pretty strong competition. A lot of good players over there. And you mentioned you'd played state footy already. I think the week after you kicked six on the G, I think you shattered your leg or your ankle pretty badly.
Yes,
from what I was reading earlier. But was that always a goal to come to Melbourne and play footy?
Extreme high and low in a week, because we played on the MCG on the Saturday. Should have won the game. In fact, only two reasons stopped us. I think Gary Dempsey took about 30 marks in the goal square, and the winning goal was kicked by Wayne Richardson, a West Australian who never played in Perth, so he came to Collingwood direct as pretty much a school end of his schooling. He came straight to, he never played senior footy in Perth. He kicked the winning goal, and then we went to Tasmania on the Tuesday to play Tasmania, and they brought the fog in, and they beat us on the oval in Hobart the following Tuesday. So we went home with no wins, and then I shattered my ankle. I dislocated it very badly, and I had probably 9-12 months off to get over that. So it was a real bummer after having played so well on the Saturday. But it was always, because really Melbourne was the centre of the universe in terms of football, certainly VFL in those days. And I guess if you wanted to put yourself to the test, then it was always the dream was. I remember as a kid on the farm, 12 o'clock on a Saturday, I'd play, turn on the ABC and listen to the game of the day that was broadcast and play my own game on the farm. And that was where it really all started, I guess, and went to Claremont, signed with St Kilda in 1970. But in those days, there was no drafting. It was really just when the club was prepared to let me go, and they said, well, we'll let you go after 5 years. I captained them for 2 or 3 years, and then I finished at the end of 73 and moved to Melbourne. Still remember it very vividly, 14th of February 1974, on a Sunday, and went down to the club. They'd played a scratch game and saw the boys. I'd known a few of them over the preceding years, and that's where it all started. And you know, it's been terrific. A lot of disappointment in some ways, but you know, that's, you never quite know. When I signed, the club played in the grand final the next year, so I was pretty excited about having made the right choice. But in the end, I never played a final, which still bugs me today.
So I was going to ask you the comparison between what the VFL was then and then what the Waffle was then. Obviously, these days there's a vast difference between the two competitions, with the VFL evolving to the AFL. What's the main, I guess, differences between the league, and what drew you more to the VFL? You were saying obviously it's the centre of the universe, but was the playing conditions a lot better? Were the perks of playing in Melbourne a lot better for yourself? What's the real thing that drew you over mostly?
No, I think it was really just the competition, where you really wanted to put yourself to play in the best competition. Conditions were much better in Perth because we never played in mud. came to Melbourne and people said, why the hell are you going there? It's cold and wet and miserable. And the G in those days was a mud heap, you know, nothing like and let alone playing indoors at Marvel. But it was really just because there was really no money in football in those days. I think I started at Claremont for 20 a win and 5 a loss, and I think I came to St Kilda in those days on about $5,000 a year, which probably wasn't too bad because you'd do it for nothing. But so I came and having played straight cricket for some years before, there was no money in cricket either. I think we were getting $12 a day playing Shield in Perth. We'd fill the whacker up, and I was very fortunate in those couple of years I played and we won the Shield with people like Dennis Lilly, Rod Marsh, Graeme McKenzie, Bob Massey. It was a pretty good team, but, you know, you understand very clearly when Kerry Packer came with his bag of money, the guys couldn't get there quick enough because there was a lot of money being made, but it wasn't going to players.
There were plenty of athletes in that era who kind of juggled a couple. I mean, obviously, Simon O'Donnell after you, Max Walker through the 70s, George Young obviously played a bit of cricket as well. But it's remarkable that obviously between playing a state game at the MCG and signing with St Kilda and coming to St Kilda, you played Shield cricket and won a Shield title. And I'm not surprised you won the title with the names you just mentioned. But was it a juggleable lifestyle, if that makes sense, or did it come a point where one had to win, if that makes sense?
Yeah, it's a good question, because in Perth, the seasons ran into each other, and I was playing with Claremont Cottesloe in the pennant cricket, and we got to the final, and I actually had to miss the first two rounds of football, even though I was captain in Claremont at the time. The coach wasn't that impressed with it, but it would have been the same the other end of the season if we'd got to the final of the football, and you wouldn't walk away from playing in the grand final to go back to cricket. So, and as it turned out, we beat our rivals were Midland Guildford, who had Norm O'Neill was part of the team, Keith Slater, some very well known names, and we had great delight in beating them for the pennant in that year at the Wacker. And Doggy Main, or Laurie Main, as people would remember him, he was our captain coach at Claremont. So we had great delight in winning the pennant that season. But it was very difficult to juggle, because the seasons did overlap each other at each end of the season. So when I came to Melbourne, I effectively walked away from cricket because you just couldn't really do the two properly. And I ended up playing with Youngie in the VJCA, I think, and we won a title with Bentley, I think, in about 1976. But it just wasn't the pressure, and it kept you fit without the pressure of going to pennant. So cricket really sort of fell away. And probably just an example, my brother Gary, who my oldest brother, he became an umpire in the Packer series. And to give you an idea of the difference, because he got quite bad treatment from the other umpires when he made the move, probably like the players did, and he got a 3-year contract with Packer, which was hardly lucrative, but it was pretty good in those days. He would have had to umpire Shield for 52 years to get the same money. So if you spread that out amongst why the players went, it was very obvious that, and I think we've all read the stories of Ian Chappell having meetings with Sir Donald Bradman and looking for some of the loot, because it was all, they couldn't get the bank. It was all in Fort Knox at the Australian Cricket Board, and Sir Donald wasn't going to open the door. So when Packer came, they were all very happy to make the move, and my brother was lucky. He had a fantastic 3 years umpiring probably the best players in the world in that series. And but then when he went back to when they all rejoined, it just never worked out. The old guard made it very difficult for him, which was disappointing, because he should have umpired tests for probably another 10 years after that. But It was just the scenario around it, and he just didn't need it, so he gave the game away, which was really disappointing. He stopped umpiring.
We're all pretty big cricket fans, so we could probably do a whole podcast on your cricket experience and some of the stories of your cricket life. But I guess back to footy. Now, the word is that the club had kind of seen you as the long-term replacement for Ross Smith, who was coming towards the end of his career. And I read a little story that Ross Smith actually came out of retirement when you got injured a little bit later on after he'd retired. But can you, I guess, walk us through what that was like, I guess, stepping into the shoes of someone like Ross Smith?
Well, I think I had the hairstyle that was probably part of the reason I got the number 3. Yes, it happened. It was 1975, and I think Ross was assistant coach to Jeansy, and I was playing at Victoria Park, the famous Victoria Park at Collingwood, and I snapped my Achilles, which was a really unusual injury in those days. I think we've had about three this year, haven't we, of players snapping Achilles. But that was in mid, I think probably June, May, June of 75. I snapped an Achilles. I was just, I'd got the ball in the middle of the ground and I'd seen a Collingwood player heading towards me. I waited to see what direction he's going. Then I went to take off and fell over, and that was it. And just in that particular position of taking off, it all obviously went to one spot, and it literally exploded off my ankle, and that was it. It was no pain. It was just incredible, you know. And so that took probably 12 months to get over, and that. So as a result of that, Smithy got his jumper back, and he came back and played the rest of that year.
So 74 being first season at the club, you've come in, won the goal kicking, won the BNF. How did you feel stepping into that team that year, and then all of a sudden having that such an impact at the team and been able to provide so much? And we didn't have a great season, but it wasn't a terrible season like some of the ones later on in your career that where we've struggled to win a match at times. But yeah, how did you feel after the first season, thinking I've done pretty well here?
Well, I was happy with my goal kicking, but I'd have to just I didn't win the best and fairest that year.
I think Glenn Elliott won the best and fairest that year.
Yeah. I would have liked to have, but I'd have to say that I didn't. I was runner-up to Jeff Dunn 80 or 81. That was about as close as I got. But, I just enjoyed being in the middle of the universe and just, you know, Alan Jeans was a phenomenal coach. I really enjoyed playing under him. And with guys like Breeny and Cowboy, Bob Murray, Glenn Elliott. We had some disappointing years. The one that got away, when I look back now, was 1978. We were on top of the ladder at one stage during the year, and then a lot of our really good fans would remember, I think it was the game against Essendon, down at Moorabbin, and there was a bit of stuff to do. I think Carl Dittrich, ran through a guy called Terry Cahill, and then on Monday, I think the headlines read, "The Saints are animals." Carl went up to Woori Yalik into his hut, I think, and they couldn't find him for quite a few days. And that was the end of, because we were close to leading the ladder, I think, midway through the year. We were in the top two or three. We had a big side, a good side. And I look back on that, and we just went missing for 3 or 4 weeks to get our, before we got our mojo back. And then we had to beat, I think, Carlton in the last game of the year at Moorabbin. And I think we beat them by about 10 goals. But we needed Fitzroy to beat Geelong at Geelong, and that's like, I think they paid him to go down there for a holiday because it was just a formality, and we missed the finals that year by 2 points. But we had the side. We had Gary Sidebottom, Carl, Rex Hunt, George Young, Loxie, I think Graham Jelly. We had a side that could have won a premiership. I've got no doubt about that if we'd had an opportunity, because we displayed it during the year, but it wasn't to be. And then the next year, at the end of 78, we lost Hunty, retired. George Young went back to Perth. Gary Loss, I think, went back to Ballarat. And if you looked at their figures, I think we lost something like combined 160 goals between them for the year. And really, that we imploded effectively, really, as a side. It was very disappointing, because that to me was the one where we could have really had something to say about the premiership that year, because we had a very big. And look, when you play with Carl Dittrich, you had 18 blokes in the opposition looking for him, They were never quite sure where he was. And they always liked to know where he was, as long as he wasn't anywhere near them. And, you know, it's a good distraction.
To put that in perspective, so, yeah, Hawthorn, North Melbourne and Carlton finished 1, 2 and 3 that year. And the back end of the year, St Kilda beat North at Arden Street, beat Hawthorn by 56 points at Waverley and beat Carlton by 50 at Moorabbin. So they were well and truly flying come the back end of that year. For those, obviously, we've discussed your statistics a little bit, but I guess in your own words, how would you describe yourself as a player? I mean, looking at your numbers, you're getting between 20 and 25 and having about 6 shots a goal a game, which is, you know, quite remarkable statistics. But if you were to describe yourself or even make a modern comparison, there aren't too many players like that, I must say, these days.
It's pretty hard. I can't remember. God, it's 50 years ago. I just enjoyed the game. I guess I was probably lucky in that I came from a very sporting family. You know, footy and cricket was our whole life. It was footy in the winter and cricket in the summer. And so we probably had the ball skills and I just enjoyed playing the game and, you know, just being part of a team. And I guess, as I said earlier, the one thing that just really still irritates me today is that I came to Melbourne to play finals, and the year before I came, St Kilda played off in 73, I think. In fact, George Young, I think, might have kicked 6 on the out at Waverley. He always reminds me every time I talk to him. And then they never played a final while I was there. And then I went to, and I guess that was disappointing too. I didn't want to leave the club. But at 33, I think the powers that be decided that I was probably over the hill. So I took my footy and went to the Dogs for a couple of years, which I really enjoyed. I think I played just under, 26 or 7 games there. A year under Bluey Hampshire, and then Mickey Malthouse took over in 84, which I really enjoyed. I played with Mick. That was much more enjoyable than playing against him because he was a bugger to play against when he was at Richmond. He was a tough nut. But he used me off the bench basically, and Dougie Hawkins named me Granddad. They used to call the crowd, call bring on Granddad. And so I sort of came on and off the ground, and probably that was a disappointment because at the end of 84, I'd played a few reserve games, and you get to that point where you're going, well, do I go on or do I get out if there's still a little bit left in the tank? They were keen for me to go on in 85, and in the end, I decided I'd finish up. And went on to the match committee in 85. And if you look at the figures there, you'd see that we were 10 points away from probably playing off in a grand final when I was in the match committee, not out in the ground. So at each end of my career in Melbourne, it still bugs me today because you came to Melbourne to play finals. You know, that's really what it's that simple. Just like I think most players today, they want to go to sides that's going to take them to the finals, and we all search for that. And some players have come from Perth and gone into a side that haven't done well, and then they've ended up playing half a dozen finals. And I remember talking to Alan Jeans before he passed away, and I said to him, "Jeansy, when I come back next time, I want to come back as Russell Green." Because I started the same day. Greeny and I started the same day on April the 6th, 1974. And as we know, he suddenly found himself at Hawthorn, and he ended up playing something like nearly 30 finals and probably 2 or 3 premierships in that time. I stayed at St Kilda and then went to the Dogs and never played a final. So I said to Yab, "I want to come back with Russell Green because you can't be that lucky." That's just the way the ball bounces, isn't it?
That's footy, yeah. Isn't it? I want to ask you about, I guess, that period leading up to your departure from St Kilda in early 83, because I think you'd only just a couple of years earlier been appointed firstly vice-captain, I think, in 1980, and then midway through 81 took over the captaincy in your own right and then had it in full for 82. And then I guess almost suddenly, yeah, at the end of 82, early 83, seemed like you were just kind of given your marching orders. Was it by Ian Stewart? I mean, what was that period like for you?
Yeah, it was disappointing. I think probably Alex Jesolenko was my saviour. I wasn't probably the top of the pops with Mike Patterson. And then when Mike got the chop and Jezza took over, he was playing, but then he became coach. I'm not sure why it was, but we just seemed to have very similar values, and I enjoyed his coaching, and he sort of pulled me out of left field to make me vice captain. I had a pretty good year, I think, in might have been 81 when I was runner up to Jeff Dunn, and I think I made the All Australian side in, I think it was 81 in the carnival, and finished up runner up to Dunny, and then Jezza made me vice captain, and then a captain in 82, I think, when he retired. And I think Stewie, when we've had a chat, Stewie and I have had a chat about it over the time, but I think basically Stewie was looking to get some youth into the team, and obviously, and I think too they were concerned perhaps even then that I'd had a couple of concussions, and even then it was raising its head, and they were concerned about my health, so as to speak. But as it turned out, they really didn't want me around, so I chose to go, and then unhappily they wanted money for me, which I thought was rather hilarious when they were keen to get me out the door. But anyway, Shane O'Sullivan was the first one to reach out to me as general manager of the Dogs, and I had quite a strong interest from Essendon. It's the old story of sliding doors. I think Noel Judson it was, and Cheeds were quite keen to get me there, but I just felt Shane had shown a lot of interest early and wanted me there, and if I'd gone to Essendon, I could have been part of an 83-84 premiership. But I retired too early and missed the 85 final, so wasn't to be.
So, yeah, it was 1980 was your All-Australian selection. I was going to ask you about that. Obviously, we see the big fanfare these days of it all, and like a big night, and they all get presented with jackets and everything. What was the, I guess, the any sort of presentation in 1980? Was it did they actually give recognition to it? Did you get a nice green jacket like they do or anything like that?
No, it's not quite like it is today. I think the side was announced, and it was probably in about 4 inches of a column in the papers announcing the Australian, All-Australian team. And we got a plaque noting that I was a member of the All-Australian team, and we got a jumper with the All-Australian green and gold jumper, which I was only looking at. We're just doing a bit of cleanup at the moment, and I came across that, and I probably should put it into a frame, but I might let my son do that.
There's a fair team that you got named in as well. And you look, there's selections from obviously different states within there. But Tommy Hafey coaching, you got named Graham Corns, Robbie Flower, Ken Hunter from West Australia with yourself. So it's a fair team to be named amongst. So yeah, there's quite a bit of pride to be put alongside those names within the league that you played in.
Yeah. Well, no, it's certainly probably one of my most strongest memories of making an All-Australian side isn't any, what are you looking at, the top 20 odd or 22 players in the carnival at that particular time. I think it was in Adelaide where it was played at that year, and to be able to make the All-Australian side was pretty special. And I think it's interesting because Youngie and I, we've sort of got a little bit of a we go back to playing schoolboys cricket in for WA I think when we were 12 and 13, back in the early 60s, and then we played Shield together, and Youngie, of course, in his first Shield game, made 100, which he'd like me to always just put that out for people to realise that he made 100 in his first time playing for WA, but that's the, you know, he was a very unique player. He was the one we really missed at St Kilda, because he was just a talent, left footer, could do most things, and he showed it on the cricket field as well. When he made 100, he made it look very easy. But he and I are sort of one of the few that came out of Western Australia that played in the Shield finals of cricket, played VFL footy, and both All Australian. I think he was All Australian probably a couple of years, a year or so before me. So I speak to him probably once a week, you know, or we might be texting each other. I nearly had to go to the psychiatrist after Sunday's game. It was weird. And I think Ross probably described it best by saying the aliens came in at half time and replaced me, because I texted Youngie and I'm saying, this, you know, it was probably the first 2 minutes of the game. I'm going, this looks bad. And then he came back a few minutes later and said, no, unbelievable. But somehow they got out of jail, which was a real credit to them. What I like about it is, which we've been crying out for a little while, is the speed, getting some speed. And, you know, we saw that in probably the first week, certainly against Collingwood, that speed that you just got to have these days. If you don't have, you just don't go anywhere. And then losing Hendry. Henry, you know, he certainly made a difference, and it was shocking to have him out for 6 or 8 weeks. But hopefully he's going to be good for the second half of the year, you know. But I just like the mix of the young kids they've got coming through and the speed. And I guess the one concern I have is I just hope Rowan Marshall stands up all year, because he's been such a great player over the last 2 or 3 years. We couldn't afford him to go down, you know. He's a key to it.
Well, it's great to hear that you're still, I guess, following the club and involved at that level, even as a supporter. But I just wanted to, I guess, we asked Stephen Ziller this last week around opinions on State of Origin footy. I mean, you played for WA before it was even called State of Origin. It was just rep footy. How do you feel about, I mean, firstly, what did playing for WA mean to you? And secondly, I guess, how do you feel about State of Origin now? I mean, would you like to see it come back? Do you understand why they don't do it anymore? Like, how do you feel about State of Origin and rep footy in general?
Oh, look, I really enjoyed playing the carnivals, and certainly that first year, 1970, having Graeme Farmer as captain coach, and coming to Melbourne, as I said, the MCG wasn't a really good surface in those days. It was probably mud. Well, it was soil, but it was very heavy. And you look at the conditions they play in now, it's just phenomenal. In fact, if you ask them, have you played in mud? They just don't play in mud anymore, because the technologies of the surfaces now are so different, with the draining of the water, that they just and the amount of sand that's used, that it just never is never mud around anymore. So it just helps the whole game. But I think the playing in the State of Origin, I think it's just so hard now, because, and someone was talking about it today, I think, or yesterday, of why they can't. If, for example, they had State of Origin and someone like Connor Rosie, you know, did his ACL, for example, playing for South Australia against Victoria, how do you recompense that? How do you come to grips with it? And I'm just not sure. The game's so different, and it's so professional, that it just doesn't lend itself, I don't think, to playing those games where you take the players away from their club. I look at the rugby, and I watched the first 5 minutes because I can't believe that it's just vicious. New South Wales and Queensland, it's just
it's amazing.
I don't watch the first five minutes because you can't believe guys can run at each other like they do. But I think the game and the health of players now is so important that I just don't think the state of origin fits in there when it's never really continued on. It sort of got dropped and it's never really, whereas the rugby kept it going.
Yeah, now that it's gone, it's hard to see that it would ever come back. The final one from me, obviously there's lots of ways you can be recognised, but Russell Holmesby, who's about as devout a historian as there could be for any football club, published his Heroes with Halos in the mid-90s, had Ian Stewart as the greatest saint of all time with the likes of Doc and Plugger and those sorts of guys up there. You were in that list of his top 100 saints of all time. Something like that, I guess, just reflecting on your career and knowing, look, I made a decision to move my life from one side of Australia to the other, and to get that recognition from club and historically that you were an incredibly successful player. How does that feel, or I guess, or sit with you?
Yeah, no, look, I look back on it with a great deal of pride, and there's a lot of guys that never made the trip across the Nullarbor in those days. We all know guys that were great amateurs, but they never took the next step up into that, semi-professional. It takes a bit of courage, and I just enjoyed, I guess, Perth in those days was quite a small town, whereas today now it's a bit of a metropolis. Just coming to Melbourne, where it really was, that's where Australian rules footy was all about, playing at the best competition. And I look back with a fair degree of pride, having, captained St Kilda. And as I said, the one bugbear is that I never played finals, because that's really why every player would come to Melbourne in those days, was to be a part of a premiership team, just like it is today. Players move trying to find the magic formula to find a club that's going to play in a final, and more importantly, be the winner on that one day in September.
Now, you've clearly told us that, yeah, you're still getting into the game and what's following the club very closely with the, going through what we all went through on the weekend and the highs and lows of it all. Still get yourself to the games, and or do you sort of more still a bit of a, I guess, a follower on the TV sort of thing? Or I guess a lot of the players we've had on previously, they still go to the past players' functions and things like that. Just still get quite involved in all that.
Mm. I still go to the past players' functions. I probably try and get to half a dozen games a year. I've been a member of the True Believers, which is one of the coterie groups, which came out of the property industry, which I was working in over the years gone by. And I really enjoyed being part of that, but I haven't really been for the last couple of years this year. So I'd go along to the games with them. But I had a little medical issue. I had a seizure back in October, so I'm actually not able to drive at the moment, which wasn't on the drawing board as far as I was concerned. And it sort of has curtailed me, because I'm living in Mornington, so it's a bit difficult to get anywhere, because we're not on the, you've got to get to Frankston to get onto the train line. And I'm sort of relying on my wife to do the driving at the moment. So in that way, it's quite frustrating that I can't get around, but I'm hopeful of being back. I'm supposed to be not driving for 12 months, which takes me up to October this year. So unless I can get my doctor and Vic Rhodes to relent, I probably won't be back on the road before then. So it certainly wasn't something I expected, and it sort of came out of left field, really, because I keep pretty good health. I'm walking 6 or 7 Ks a day, which I feel quite privileged, because I look at a lot of my mates who played footy, and they're all having hip replacements, knee replacements. A lot of them can't walk that far, you know. So I'm quite happy with the fact that I'm still pretty active and being able to get out and walk most days and keep myself in reasonable shape.
Well, that is a blessing given the injuries that you had across the course of the career. But we appreciate you jumping on. It's been fantastic reminiscing over that time. You've been a popular request amongst our listenership. So we wish you well. Thank you very much for your contribution to the Saints and for your time with us tonight.
No, I appreciate it. And thanks for thinking of me and remembering back 50 years, because a lot of times it doesn't happen. So thanks for the time. We look forward to seeing what happens for the rest of the year, and hopefully it's an improvement on last year, because I don't think any of us could have had any problems with last year. I thought we did remarkably well the year we had under Ross for the first year, and hopefully the kids will continue to grow and they get a bit of a smell, and more importantly, they stay together, because that's we all know you've got to stay together for the next 4 or 5 years to really, I think, have an impact. So let's hope that happens, and appreciate it. Thanks, guys.
We look ahead to the Giants on the back of that round 5. GWS unbeaten, knocked us out of the finals last year, of course, at the MCG, and looked impressive that day. 1:45 Saturday game, so we have a 6-day break into a 5-day break. We've got the Bulldogs on a Thursday, the following week, but more on that later. In terms of changes, you would think that Windhager for Caminiti, and I think because just looking at their structure last week, they tried to play Caminiti as a second ruckman. It didn't really work, which meant that he had to stay forward, which meant that Sharman had to stay higher up the ground, which didn't necessarily suit him either.
He was okay, though, put a bit of press.
He was okay, yeah, but he was good, but I don't think they wanted to play him there, so they could just mess the structure up. King had to stay forward. Marshall rucked the whole way through. Owens in the midfield. So I just think getting Windhager back in there, Sharman had played forward, Caminiti goes out. The only other change I could see them making is they might feel Hasty needs a run after limited minutes as a sub. So whether it's Garcia or Collard or something like that, would be about all I'd see. Yeah,
or whatever pulls up as well after some training, because he looked like he was in some fair pain. Like I said earlier, I think I was surprised they didn't sub him out at that point, because it looked like he was in real pain and real trouble. And the fact that they brought him back on and then waited another kind of 20 minutes of play to bring Hasty on for Zach Jones was really surprising. It could be
he must have mentioned
to give Hill a rest on Monica.
Yeah, he must have mentioned to him saying, look, no, it's not some sort of joint or something. It was just a big whack across the leg, and that can really hurt at times too. It's you've ever kicked the table or something with your shin, and it can be quite painful for a short while. So luckily that seems to be the thing. But I brought up before, Dougal Howard, if he passes training Thursday, there's a possibility that he could play. Does he come in at all, do we think, or?
Yeah, I mean, they might look at the final last year, which was, you mentioned Zane Cordy's hasn't played many bad games. It was probably the only time I've seen him beaten was the final against the Giants last year, and Howard was available then, and that was obviously we had the Membry situation, and they played Caminiti, and you know if they had their time again, Cordy might have played forward and Howard played back. So I still think you'd want Howard to have a run in the Scoobs before he comes up. So, and then whether, you know, Paddy Dow's right to play VFL this week and plays a game or two down there, we'll see. But
it's interesting. Yeah, the Dougal Howard one's an interesting one, because I think it was Rory Sackville, who we've spoken to on the podcast before, I think called in one of our live episodes or potentially last year.
He did,
before. Mentioning it in a WhatsApp group with Rory and a bunch of other Saints fans. And he did mention that the difference between Dougal Howard was he had a full preseason. It was only in the last quarter or second half of that final preseason game where he had that the tightness or the pain or whatever, and that was kind of it. But he had a full preseason, unlike some of the other guys like Paddy Dow or Hunter Clark or whatever, that have kind of struggled to get through preseason. Dougal Howard had a full preseason. And so it shouldn't take much if he's training well to get him back into the seniors. And it might just be he needs, you know, one or two decent, you know, training sessions to get him back in the team. But he's not that far away.
Yeah, and that's a it's a good dilemma to have, because we've been thinking there was only two options, et cetera, to make any changes in the last few weeks. So just to get some soldiers back is important. Obviously, Toby Green escaped suspension. The AFL forgot this week that it was all about preventing the action, which is exactly why Max King was suspended against Collingwood, because they wanted to discourage players from committing actions that might injure somebody, and they just forgot about that this week. And a player that's been suspended 8,000 times, they decided not to this week. But that's the way it goes, I guess. You know, we can lament our misfortune, but that's sort of the way it tends to fall. Look, they're clearly a very good side, possibly the best side in the competition, or probably the best side in the competition as it stands at the moment. But it is still a fairly even competition. We beat them there last year. That was just before they went on the run. We've beaten them there a few times of late, but clearly they're humming along. Their midfield's in really good form with Tom Green and even youngsters like Finn Callahan, and obviously the veterans in Canelio and Kelly and those sorts of players. The big fella Briggs in the rucks, you know, a good challenge for Marshall. Their defence is superb, led by Taylor. And then obviously Hogan, Riccardi, Brown, Green, Bedford, those sorts of players forward. So a very good side, but I was kind of thinking about it a little bit during the week that we had a bit of margin for error against Richmond, and that we were terrible for large parts of the game, but we're good enough to wrestle our way through. Playing a side like the Giants, you have less margin for error, so you can make less mistakes. You've got to be more efficient. You don't have as much room to waste inside 50s or to turn balls over in the middle of the ground and those sorts of things. So it's not to say you have no margin for error, you just have less. So you've clearly got to be sharper for longer. But it's not an impossible game to win. Like, clearly we're the underdogs in it because we're down at some personnel and they're probably humming along as the premiership favourites as it stands now. But if we do execute properly, we have enough match winners that we are a chance to win the game without a shadow of a doubt. So that's kind of the way I look at it, that we can't be as rough around the edges as we were against Essendon and Richmond. But if we are as dangerous as we were against Collingwood, for example, then we give ourselves a chance.
The one thing that worries me, I think, is the, and I think maybe we underestimated the impact of missing Jimmy Webster. And I really felt like in that first half last week, we missed Jimmy Webster. It was your Shai Boltons and your Dustin Martins and, you know, this kind of small, medium sized forwards that, you know, really with speed and toughness, and skill, obviously, with the ball in hand, that kind of really hit us hard. And I know that GWS have Hogan and Cadman as big bodies up forward, but they've got a bunch of smalls as well that hit the scoreboard really regularly. And I feel like Jimmy Webster is someone who would be so important in this one. I know Liam Stock has been really serviceable. I think he's been pretty good for us this year in Webster's absence, playing a really defensive role that potentially is not as suited to. But this would be Jimmy Webster would be a really good player to be able to bring back this week for this forward line. And it's just a shame. You know, obviously, he's got to pay the price for an action that we don't want to see anymore. But I feel like we potentially underestimated the impact that missing Jimmy Webster would have on our defense over these first couple of weeks.
Yeah. Yep. I think that's certainly been the case. Yeah.
Yeah, we kind of don't really have a like for like. That's the thing. I mean, Bonner came in and plays a role, but not the role that
not a lockdown. Jimmy plays.
Similar to Jack Sinclair type. You
know, yeah.
Yeah.
So it's just, you just don't have that replica, I guess, to bring in that Patton may have been able to do a little bit of it.
He would have been the one, but
we just don't have that player available at the moment. And it's just going to have to find a different way to beat him on the day. And that's beating him further up the ground rather than trying to beat him 30 metres out from goal. You just try to keep him away from it, trying to
don't give him space. Don't give him the opportunity to just run off you and pop up in a spot where when you've lost him. Someone just has to stick with him on the day and just make it as hard as possible to actually get the ball, because he can't be damaging without the ball. And that's it's as simple as we can make it. Just deny. And yeah, hopefully that's how we can try and beat him, because simply he's if he fires up, we're in trouble. Simple.
Yeah, and look, he hasn't ripped us a new one, generally speaking. He's always dangerous and usually kicks a few, but I can't remember times where it's like, shit, he's ripped this completely away from us on his own. But look, those matchups in the past might be part of the reason for that. Jesse Hogan's in super form, but I feel like we can handle, you know, key position forwards okay with our stocks. That's not to say they won't have an impact. It's just what happens at ground level. And their class on the outside sliced us up in the final last year. So hopefully there's been a bit of homework on, you know, locking down some of that outside speed and things like that. So very good side. But, I mean, it's been actually quite remarkable, their transformation. They went from a bottom four side in the middle of last year to 3 weeks later being one of the best sides in the comp. And they've stayed that way with the same group. Yeah. So
they probably incredible last year.
Probably. And I'd say so. I mean, they were about to beat Collingwood in the prelim, and they probably would have won the grand final given how well they were defending as well. It's a credit to Adam Kingsley for what they've been able to do. But look, we go up there, you know, up against it to a degree, but we're it's a final side playing a premiership contender, so you're a chance. And we'll see where it lands from there. But the other way is that we dropped a game against Essendon that we never should have lost, and our belief as soon as the siren sounded there was, oh, we've got to pick one up somewhere now. We were favourites against Richmond, so that doesn't count. You've got to pick one up which you're not expected to win. So like this, or Port Adelaide away, or Sydney, or Melbourne at the MCG, or something like that. You've got to get one back. Yeah. So this is our first chance to get one back.
There's only two teams that are unbeaten, you know, after four or five weeks, depending on who you've played and what you've played.
Yeah.
But all it says, really, I mean, if you're in the coaching group, you know, this week, you're talking about how the Giants are due. You know, they're going to have a loss. No team's going to go through the season unbeaten. That would be unbelievable. And the odds of that happening are so rare that for the next few weeks, and, you know, until they have a loss, they're due. And so why not us? We've shown that when we play our best footy that we can compete with the best teams in the league. You know, we've shown that over the last 18 months. So why not? If we turn up and we play our footy, we play our game style, we play, you know, Saints footy, that we can be competitive.
Just some listener questions that relate a bit to selection. So I'll ask the questions in the hope that we've already answered some of these. Stuart says Dougal or Cordy. Hopefully we've addressed that for you, Stu. Patrick asking if Butler still has a place in the team, issues over preseason, but speed is non-existent. Did mention that hopefully he'll work back into it, but he was tempted with Collard maybe to get a game there. Chad asking who Windy comes in for. Look, Windy for Caminiti is probably the one. Not sure Hayes would play yet, given the VFL didn't play last week, but you never know. A couple of others. Mateus had thoughts on Garcia for Burns, similar to your talk around Burns with the Shannon Knoll, but I think Garcia would be more likely to play as a sub in place of Hasty. And a couple of others. So John says, when you tell the supporters you've been working on connection all year and it still looks like trash, who's to blame? I don't think it's looked like trash all year. It struggled on Sunday, but I think, look, our connection against Collingwood was elite. It's just been a bit inconsistent, I guess. And the last two, H, Bobber says, Zach Jones is a liability three quarters of the time. When he finally hit a target with a kick in the third quarter, I drank an entire bottle of tequila. Please discuss. Discussing the tequila or Zach Jones? I assume Zach Jones. But,
Did he have a last quarter?
Does he have a recommendation for tequila or have a hookup?
Yeah,
which manufacturer? The brand? Yes.
Jones has a position in the team. There is a position there for him.
we don't always seem to get the best of what we probably could from him. But we got to remember how much he missed last year. He's kind of still getting into the Ross game, I would suggest, a little bit. He's still getting there, but Ross wouldn't be playing him if he didn't have a role. And that's the simple way. We know if a player is playing, Ross has a role for them. And he'd be dropped if he wasn't playing it. And we can put that to bed straight away going, look, he's obviously doing what he's been asked. And, yeah, and we don't know what his role is particularly, but, yeah, it's as simple as that.
I think we talked about it last week. I think that it's just he's a point of difference, right? Like, we do have generally a fairly pedestrian midfield group. You know, there's a lot of players that have similar kind of pace profiles and running profiles. Obviously, bringing Wilson in, it gives us a different ability. The ability to run Owens and Filippo gives us a different look, but they're not ready for full-time midfield duties just yet. Zach Jones gives us a toughness and a burst out of stoppage that just about no one else in our midfield group does. And no, he's not perfect. Yes, we know that there's disposal efficiency issues and whatever, but there is a point of difference that he brings to our lineup that no one else does. And so that's his spot, I think.
And he sits under the footy and has taken some hits and some courageous marks. And I mean, I think he's building back to fitness and he's been okay. So you're not too disappointed with that. And the final one from Toby, just asking about realistic expectations over the next few weeks with injuries. If I look at the fixture, I think 4-4 after 8 games is an acceptable position to be in. Our draw gets better after that. And I think 4-4, even 5-5 after round 10 gets us a good opportunity to launch from there with players available. So I would take maintaining a 50-50 run through this sort of first half of the year and with an expectation that we've got a chance to build better than that after the halfway point. So some might consider that to be aiming low, but I think that keeps us in the fight, to be honest. Well, so
our second half fixture is better than the first half.
Yeah. Correct. Yeah.
And you wanted this to be 3-3 last year, and what did we do? And
Hopefully, let's get to 3-3, and we'll 5-1.
Hopefully, you can curse the same way.
after the Giants, we've got the Bulldogs at Marvel, Port in Adelaide, North at Marvel,
then North,
and Hawthorn in Tassie.
Then Freo at Marvel.
That's right. So none of them. Like, you look at North and you go, well, that should be a gimme, but we know that we don't have that historically. We don't have gimmies. But you imagine if you can get through and you can beat, you know, the Bulldogs at Marvel, because we should be beating the Bulldogs at Marvel. Port in Adelaide is a tough one because we never can beat that mob and they're awful. We should beat North. We should beat Hawthorn, but we should have beaten Hawthorn last year. And like this, they're pretty good, Hawthorn. Like, I like the way they're going.
Yeah, no easy. No easy game. So, I mean, Freo at Marvel, again, you'd look at it on paper and think, why not? But they're going pretty well. So, I mean, if the expectation is, if you look at it in isolation, that we're underdogs in the two games against the Giants away and Port away, and we play the Bulldogs and North at Marvel, you would expect to beat North, not a given. If you beat the Bulldogs but lose the two interstate games, you're 4-4. And then, obviously, if you pinch one of those interstate games, super, you lose the Bulldogs game, you fall behind the eight ball. So, simplifying it like that, that's kind of what it looks like. But you know, first step Giants, if you beat them, that entire equation changes. And why not? Played them in a final last year and, you know, stood toe to toe at a national anthem. We were there, and obviously they've kicked on a bit, but bring it on. We've got to get that game back somehow. And thanks for tuning in. Thanks to Brewster Brusel too. That was one of our favourites, and a big go Saints.
Quick shout out just at the end for Ross, who finally, after a long time, coaches his 150th game for St Kilda this week. There's only one coach in our 150-year history that's coached more games than Ross Lyon, and that is Alan Jeans, the only man who's won the premiership, and Ross Lyon is the closest to have gotten there since. So well done, Ross Lyon.
And to put that in perspective, he's 150 games as coach. He's won 91 of them. So
he's got the best winning percentage of any St Kilda coach over the course.
So, tremendous strike rate. And obviously there should be a couple more in there and some trophies. But, yeah, hopefully he can lead us to the promised land as Finey predicted in our episode a few weeks back. But, yeah, onwards and upwards. If you haven't jumped on our socials, jump on it and like all of those. And good luck wherever you're watching this week.